Everyone faces questions and decisions that require insight and answers as we move forward personally, professionally, and corporately in all areas of this thing we call life in America today. Hello, this is Joe Schofield, and I invite you to tune in every Monday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. as we talk together and hear from key leaders of all ages and backgrounds about your questions. Interesting, informative, intuitive, but always encouraging. Tune us in on BBS Radio Network.
Join Pastor Joe and co-hosts Commander Rob Hansen, Nancy Hansen, Dr. Paul Hall, Stephanie Thayer, and Dr. Craig Thayer in Raising Expectations.
Who comprises the team? We're going to do it a little quickly tonight so we can spend more time on our program. As you know, our co-host team is comprised of Dr. Paul Hall, retired pastor and theologian, and he's right there on my right and your left or the center, depending on how you're looking at it. And we have with us tonight also, as you know, Naval Commander Rob and Nancy Hansen, Annapolis graduate and a Top Gun pilot and trainer, and his commander, his wife, Nancy, Commander Nancy. And so we're excited that they are together with us. Very, very special people. We also have with us Dr. Craig and Stephanie Thayer. They moved to Georgia, so they're our East Coast connection, and we love them also. Dr. Craig is a trauma surgeon, takes good care of us when we need it the most. And Stephanie is a wellness and health coach. I say world-renowned, Stephanie. You do such a great job. We follow you all the time. We're going to be so healthy that we'll put Tank out of business. Sorry, Tank and listeners. Actually, we're going to be in good shape. So kind of comprises our team. Tonight we have with us a very special guest, Mr. Robert Orlando, who is a filmmaker and a producer and a writer and a historian. All the things that we talk about so often and understanding what's happening in our nation today and around the world. Here's a man who has not only studied it, he's lived some of it, and he's written about it. I wanted to read something he said back to me today, and we're going to do the same format, folks. We're going to open it up, let him share, and then we'll have some questions. He said, "We look forward to being with you." His wife, his publicist, Margot, has sent this for us. He'll be discussing his faith with us and how he integrates that journey that combines film and history and media with his life, which is where we live. That's the kind of thing that raises expectation. Now, the theme we're going to talk about tonight is the Cold War. And it's a common thread we're going to see that weaves its way all the way through from Patton that we're going to see, his latest book that and movie you're going to see in a moment, The Divine Plan, which was about the Pope John Paul and President Reagan. It was a tremendous book a few years back, and movie. I'll tell you about it. And also, he's got a great movie, a new one coming out we're going to wrap the program up with tonight, and it is simply called... And I'm going to say this as a pastor. You get to say this when you read titles. To hell with Karl Marx. You're really going to like this when you hear him explain what this is about. Because when you listen to him, you not only hear his heart, but you know who this guy is and you feel his life. And it draws us closer to what we know we're here for. So we're going to begin, as you've seen all week, I've had a lot of responses in on all kinds of social media back about the book, The Tragedy of Patton or The Silence of Patton Film. We're going to run a clip for him, Robert, and then we're going to welcome you right after and introduce you to share from your heart with us along this line, beginning with Patton. All right. First of all, show the film right now. Show us that trailer, and then we're going to bring Robert Orlando.
December 9th, 1945. 7 months since the end of the war in Europe. On a war-torn two-lane highway in Mannheim, Germany, the most formidable U.S. general of the Second World War, General George S. Patton, sustains life-threatening injuries when a 2-ton army truck crushes his Cadillac sedan on the eve of his departure for the U.S. He is unable to move from the neck down. The other occupants of the vehicle walk away from the accident largely unscathed, but old Blood and Guts is left to cling to life in a Heidelberg hospital.
So General Patton was actually planning on coming home and telling the truth about what happened over there and all of the bad decisions that were made. And Eisenhower, Bradley, they were all scared that Patton was going to tell the truth and all the things that they did wrong were going to come out.
At one point, Eisenhower told his son John, "I'm not getting rid of Patton for what he just did. I'm getting rid of him for what he's going to do next." Patton was a liability.
Patton had a way of saying truths that other people didn't want to listen to.
There would have been people in FDR's administration who would have detested George Patton. The fact that Patton thought that the Soviets were the threat, or at least the future threat post-war.
He was going to argue that we had been naive in partnering with the Russians.
The FDR administration had a bunch of people who were, in some cases, outright Soviet spies, strong Soviet sympathizers, dupes, soft on communism.
And when you put that all together, that right there could spell conspiracy.
Robert, we want to welcome you. Welcome for being with us. Thanks for being here. And
thank you.
Go right ahead and share, if you would, give us some insight on how you got in films and what you feel in all these things. We appreciate you.
Well, one, thank you for having me at the Knights of the Roundtable here. I like the whole group approach to this. Number two is, can I just quickly address the Patton film?
Absolutely. And
then maybe go into the story because it's kind of lingering in the air. I think the audience would...
Absolutely.
This would be, by using the example of Patton, I think I can get at the arc of probably my career in a different way. I would start by saying that usually I'm plagued by a question that's either unresolved in my mind or hasn't been fully expressed, or it's a way of opening up a part of history that maybe the faith side hasn't been seen, or various reasons. But usually it's something that I feel like no one has answered in a satisfactory way. So with Patton, the central question was, for me, was World War II. Since I was fairly young, I always thought to myself, why did we fight and win Western Europe and then leave Eastern Europe to the communists and allow them to suffer for 50 years? Now, I was open to what that answer was. But when I realized that Patton, after the war, was saying the same thing on the ground when the army was still there, that really sparked it for me and said, you've really got to tell, it's not just your story, your question, but actually Patton is prophesying the same issues that you were concerned of. And he didn't quite understand it either. He still wanted to stay on the ground and finish the war. And actually says, it's not an exact quote, but he said, if we just win Western Europe and leave, we have failed at this war. He knew what the stakes were. So I guess that would be a way to kind of probe into my career, as I think it is a combination of things. Historian last, I would say I'm a dramatist who finds in history important moments and then does my homework about them. I'm not strictly a historian, but you could say in certain areas I probably know more than most. But my career started when I was about 8 years old, 9 years old. I just found myself with a film camera, a friend of mine, and we played around with film. And I kind of left it behind and did the usual things, elementary school, high school. And when I got to going from high school to college, I was 17. I had a faith. If you're Catholic, you'll say renewal. If you're Protestant, you'll say conversion. But it was a moment where I wanted to look for the deeper meaning of life. And I was in a Catholic school at the time. And I probed deeper into the whole idea of what did my faith really mean? And I asked God, if you're real, please show yourself to me. And it was at that moment, I wouldn't say it happens all at one time, but it was a profound period of my life and maybe down to one moment at a certain point. And I felt like together came both my calling as a multimedia filmmaker, writer, but also on this faith journey. I guess you would use a model like a Renaissance model, where there's faith and theology is the queen and philosophy the king, but it all expresses itself through all the various arts. And that was a pretty strong calling that hasn't left me yet. So I kind of follow on that thread. And I think everything along the way is another piece. Sometimes I don't understand it until I see it in retrospect, but all of it seems to tie together to be this marrying together again of film and mainstream thinking with faith, bring faith back into the public arena, but not to preach, but to expose that. I actually think it's impossible to live a life without faith. I don't mean that in a helpless way. I mean that faith is impossible to have a closed system and function and make sense of the world. So I could talk about it on any level. I'm glad I got this exceptional panel to work with here. So yeah, that's my beginning.
Amen. Anybody have a question?
Well, I know, and again, I don't want to talk over everybody else, but I do know a couple things about the military in World War II and Patton. First of all, I'm sure a lot of people saw the movie Patton with George C. Scott. There was also a second movie, I don't know if it was called Patton 2 or something, where that actually went into his car accident, which left him paralyzed. A lot of people don't realize, unlike George C. Scott, that Patton had a very high-pitched voice. So George C. Scott, his and the impression he gave, I think a lot of people, of Patton was, you know, gruff, sounding deep, and that kind of stuff. When in fact his voice wasn't like that at all. There was also a scene, I think, in the Patton movie where, you know, he got Beetle Smith upset about, you know, him at the end of the war saying, yeah, we need to, you know, go to the Russians or we're going to have to fight them anyway, you know, that kind of thing. And again, in hindsight, because as most people may or may not be aware, Washington screws up everything they ever touch when it comes to war. And Patton was a warrior and he knew war, he knew history, and he understood what ended up being, you know, what, 60, 70 years of communist domination of Eastern Europe that may or may not have happened had warriors been in charge and understood what really needed to be done, which, of course, wasn't done. And that resulted in the Cold War, of which I was a member on our side for 20 years. So that's all I have to say.
Yeah, there you go.
Let me break that down a little bit, because you said a lot. So, yeah, he was the governor of Bavaria, asked to watch, to govern Bavaria after the war, and Patton was not a patient man. Patton was all business when it came to war. You said several things, but I think the most important thing for me was realizing, I call it the tragedy of Patton for three reasons. One was, we'll talk about his accident or not. That's the fatal event that led to the end of his life. But also because he felt he always had a sense of destiny in his life, where he felt like he had the hand of God on him, although it was kind of a reincarnated version of his Christianity. But he always believed he was part of a legacy that would have to die as a heroic general and was going to fulfill that no matter what. So it was kind of like non-heroic or unheroic in the end to wind up in a car accident in a hospital when he should have died on the battlefield. But with that said, he worried about that his entire life from World War I all the way up to the point. And in fact, he got to fight the Battle of the Bulge and led, I think, which is like crossing the Delaware, if you get into the details of what he did to turn around 100, it was almost 500,000 men and go 100 miles north in a blizzard, just crazy stuff. But if you start getting into details, you realize that he was that. But to your point, so whenever I deal with a subject matter, I'm going to kind of set the platform. I think of it as the myth, the man, and the mission. This is how I break it down in my head. Because if not, I'll be tormented with every, because whatever audience I'm with, they may want more myth, they may want more man, they may want more mission. Now, I have found the mission is the safe way to understand someone the best, because you get to see them through action, not the thoughts of others or the imperfections of themselves, which is too weak. So if you start with the myth, which is the George C. Scott 1970 film, which I love, I've watched it probably 50 times, even before I did the film. But the whole idea of that rough, bravado, like that gets a piece of Patton. Like he knew how to turn that on. And there's no doubt he was a bit of a rebel. And I don't want to overwhelm everyone with too many details, but that film was also based on Bradley's two biographies. And Bradley wasn't a total fan of Patton and made him more the rebel. They also were selling Patton to the 1960s, early 70s audience. So they wanted to make him more of a rebel than he really was, which he was, but not in the way he's portrayed totally. But some of the details that touched me more as a filmmaker is, one, you can get a, they called him Mickey Mouse. That's how high-pitched his voice was. And he was very insecure about that. But what people don't realize is that a lot of this started from a deep insecurity in life, which they believe could have been dysgraphia or something at life where he had learning challenges young. He was largely raised by women and was very insecure about whether he could take it in a battle. And so he built an artifice, which was not uncommon for men of the time. And I don't think in the military general, I've never served, unfortunately, I wish I did, but to build the artifice necessary to sustain a moment of war, to be a leader, the French call it élan vital, the vitality of like showing others you could take it. You could. He built that over such a period of time, knew how to turn it on, but it wasn't from a falseness. It was from his obligation to lead. And he did that. But I do believe what makes him so enigmatic, worthy of another documentary, and I hope one day a film maybe. I think it's time since 1970. But if you get into him, he's incredibly complex, enigmatic, and he's probably like most interesting figures who really get a lot done. He's probably a contradiction in terms. He's probably deeply insecure in certain areas and incredible, but he was a Renaissance man. He studied every topographical map of France. He knew where he was above sea level when he was fighting, and he knew how many socks to order, which was one of the reasons he survived the Bulge. So crazy intellect, very insecure, and the George C. Scott somewhere in between all of that. But his mission, he won most of the big battles in the war. You could argue the Brits hung in there too long. We had to kind of jump in there because the Brits were fighting alone for a long time. But after that was, after we entered the war, he won most of the big battles. And the ones where they pulled him out because of the slapping incident, we didn't win. So profound character.
Now, Robert, he had married a woman of means, I guess that's a good way of putting it. So after World War One, he ended up kind of being a real gentleman officer, I guess, because he could afford to be, right?
He married into the richest family in the country.
Yeah.
That doesn't hurt. That doesn't hurt. But he was, so he came in fourth, I believe, in this triathlon in 1915, I forget what the Olympics were, like a couple of years before World War One. He came in fourth in the trial. He was a national equestrian rider. And the test, I forget the exact way it happens, but in the test where you're tested with a pistol, he had the legend of like only creating one hole after 20 shots. So he was just like, again, the Renaissance, you get the whole package, but he was definitely an elitist. He spoke fluent French. So when he was with his men, he was both envied, and the men also thought he was a bit of an elitist because he saw himself as almost this 19th century figure fighting in the modern world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone else?
Oh, one of the blessed things I got to do was take my oldest son. I have this library of films that my sons need to see that I think are character creating. And Top Gun is one of those. It disappeared. Anyway, the Patton was
he went to get his plane.
He's taking care of the dogs.
Patton was up there, and it's a 3-hour-long movie. Mm-hmm. And my oldest watched it, and then he had to give a paper on leadership. Who was a motivational leader that they've seen in their life? And he wrote on Patton and played the scene of him slapping the post-traumatic stress syndrome person. Yeah, so...
Mm-hmm.
And then we did a Band of Brothers walk on our own. So we rented a car, landed in France, Paris, and headed out to Normandy, hired guides, Battle of the Bulge. And I'd met a patient 2 weeks before that was in one of those foxholes, kind of a God moment. And there's these drums that are made of cement that are all patented, so some distance to where he was. And then we went to Luxembourg, which is where he was buried. And I didn't realize until that trip that he was hit by a car. I'm like, what an unworthy way to go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but an incredible cemetery because it's an arc all the way around. And
hey, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I mapped the same exact, so for part of the promotion of the film, and it's documented on my site. I could even follow up with some links for you guys. I think you'll really like it. But I came in on Normandy and then went right across France to Luxembourg.
Right.
I tracked them all the way to the Ardennes Forest.
Yeah,
and you also see all the towns going by with the tanks when you see the black and white film.
Oh,
you see them going by on the highway. But so I went to the cemetery, and you know, they so many people visited him, they had to move him away from his men. He wanted to be with his men. Barry had to put him because the footprints were getting on everyone else's train. So it was incredible. It was like an existential moment for me to finally be there. I have an uncle who served in the 4th Armored Division under Patton. I don't know if he met him one-on-one, but he flew in free. He flew in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And a lot of the people in my family served. But when I went to West Point to see the Patton statue and the graduate, the whole thing there, the whole site, which I was blown away by, and by the way, parenthetically, was going also to see, because I learned that that's where George Washington knew to block the British supplies coming down the river. I never connected that. And he also was involved at West Point. But if you get into that, it's an amazing moment. I don't want to keep going, but it's an amazing thing to be there and to witness what he did and how fast he moved. He was a cavalryman, so he knew how to move. Once he had daylight, he was gone.
Yeah. Amen. Do you think he could have stopped? I know that question you thought about east and west. So many people have asked the question. We talked about it today a little, Paul and I. Do you think that if they had listened more to what he was saying, they could have prevented at least the extensiveness of the Cold War? I mean, got any insight on that maybe?
So this is always the balance again between the myth and the man again, because technically when you hear the fanfare is that he wanted to go to war with the Soviet Union. He didn't want to go to war. What he thought he deserved was the right to meet them at the original borders, because toward the end of the war, Russia wasn't stupid. They had set things up in the meetings of the Big Three, and they were just gobbling up real estate. So he was asking, he's like, I have 500,000 men and all the gas I need. This is the greatest army the United States has ever amassed, and I'm outside of Prague. Give me the green light to go back. Because once you push him back, and Churchill was calling into Eisenhower, saying to him, let us meet the Russians as far east as we can. They were trying to get him back. And I fortunately or unfortunately wrote like a 10,000 word paper on why Eisenhower did not let him do it. I ultimately came away that it was a political blunder, but I don't think there was any like malice, or he was fighting on two fronts. He had to satisfy every general in the war. It was pretty complicated. And the Russians had sacrificed over 10 million people. And at that point, you got to do a little dance with the devil. So he was playing his cards. But looking back, it was a political blunder, because I think we could have pushed them back. They would have been at a disadvantage, but just stopped at their original borders, probably saved Prague and Czechoslovakia, Austria, a lot of those countries from the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, I remember that. I think it was the Yalta Conference where Churchill and Stalin and FDR were meeting, where, again, I don't know the exact details, but I sense that because that was nearer the end of war, before FDR died, that some trade-offs were made, that some discussions went on between Stalin and FDR and Churchill that ended up, again, politically giving something to the Soviets for their sacrifices in the war. And of course, Churchill probably was going crazy with that. But then Churchill was also practical as well as, you know, a big thinker. FDR, he was a politician. So I have a feeling that much of what resulted from the end of the European part of World War II came from Yalta.
You're spot on. So I described a few. First of all, I think I came to this conclusion and had to come up with a delicate language, because I don't think FDR was anti-American. I think he was pro-American and misguided in his politics at the time for reasons we can go into. But I think Stalin was playing chess and everyone else was playing checkers. Mm-hmm. He's playing the long game. And the thing he did was he made sure he had control in the agreement of the unconditional surrender of the Germans. Because you realize as Patton and Simpson's Ninth Army are coming into Berlin, they're waving us down. They want to surrender to us. And this is like maybe a month or two before the end of the war, because they want to give themselves in, because they know what's coming when the Reds come into Berlin. And they haven't been all that nice in Russia themselves. So they're terrified of the Russians, which is why they had the Volk army, the Volkstrom late in the war, the kids and the old men come out and prisoners come out and protect them. They were feared. They were horrified of them coming in. So all I was saying is that he's not fighting to start a war, although you could argue he might have caused that. But I think he was just trying to say we need to back them up. That's why he maintained panzer divisions in Germany, and he wanted to create, keep their intelligence, their apparatus together, like the Ba'athists in Iraq, because he knew you're not going to run a whole. He was the governor; he had to run a whole country. How am I going to run it? There's no infrastructure, but the politics was coming so hard to punish the enemy and disband Germany that he didn't have a chance to kind of make wise decisions there. But to what someone said earlier, I think the question is, who gets to make these decisions, the politicians or the general? And sometimes politicians have to back off and let the general make the choice. And that's usually where the blunders come.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Someone else?
So, Rob, do you think, first of all, what a pleasure to have you on our podcast. Thanks. I mean, I read some interviews today that you've had with other people and some, you know, probing kind of things. And I like to kind of probe that just a little bit. You know, you spoke about, before we get there, do you think we have any patents today?
So I was there for a little while with Mattis. I just love Mattis. I thought he was like fearless. And if you know his story, and he's also, he had one book in his pocket that he kept his whole life and gave it to every soldier. And since then I do the same thing. And it was Marcus Aurelius. If you know the life of Marcus Aurelius, I believe it's like 180 AD, or top of my head, 200 AD, 180 AD. But he was one of the greatest generals that ever lived. That was the single most powerful man, probably in history. He had the army. He had, you could imagine it all in one, like imagine communism and the military and everything together. But he, in his private notes, I think he was so singularly in a position. They lived through plague. He lost many children, but he decided he would live a life of virtue. And wrote these meditations to himself. He probably couldn't talk to anyone else because he had no peers, but he wrote them to himself, and one of his commanders ultimately let it out of the bag, and it became the famous meditations. But when I hear things like that about Mattis, it's like one example of giving you how much I respect, like someone who would know enough to think that far back and understand. But it was a stoic ideal of life, right? Like you let go what you can't control, you stay strong for the fight. You know, the dead are going to die, but you keep moving on. It's a military man's, right? So I would say Mattis to that degree, but then what started to happen with the politics where he spoke out, it kind of threw me with Trump, because I guess I don't, we can go there if you want, but other than him, no. And I would tell you this, I got to know Victor Davis Hanson pretty well over the years from doing this. He would say over and over again, there are no patents there. He was, that Schwarzkopf was kind of an inflated patent himself, but I can't think of any.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm not trying to be negative. I wish I could. I'd probably be reading your work right now. I don't
think you'd be a negative. No, Robert, you're absolutely right. I've been following this, and you're right about there's no patents. And I know too much about this, so I'm not going to talk about what I know.
Okay.
It's too depressing.
And you probably know, more than I do. It's just instinct for me, but I'm saying some knowledge, some seeking out these things, like reading all the great, I mean, you know, MacArthur would have, you know, probably been the last one. You probably could put a match on him to some degree, but he was just like a man trained for war. I just don't think our culture understands. I mean, I'm not a military man. I know people who are, but he was a man bred for war. And, you know, Victor Davis Hanson put it well in the film. Every now and then you got to dust one of those guys off and take him out of a closet. Yeah. With the fear of God, the whole bunch of people. And he did that. I mean, that was the weapon we had. And he was the only one the Germans tracked, by the way. They didn't care about the other generals. They just tracked him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, and when Victor Davis Hanson talks, you listen. Yeah. And when he writes, you read him.
I went to him, and he didn't know I was thinking this way, but I said to myself, if I don't get him in the film, I'm not going to do it. Like, that was my one... John, if you want me to make this film, I got to get Hanson in the film. I went to his office at Pepperdine and got a great talk. And he knew I was serious, and he had written a little bit on Patton, but I just knew his worldview. Like, he's a realist. So he's not going to talk in fancy language or politically safe language. So I was in a very comfortable space.
Yeah. Amen. Paul, you had another thought on that?
No, I was curious. I tried to catch up and read Rob about what inspires you to, you know, tell your stories? And while ago you spoke about your, was it your Catholic renewal? Is that what you called it?
I don't know what to call it. Transformation. Oh, no.
That's a great description, really, honestly. But when I found in my reading about in some of the interviews that you had, you said, if I remember correctly, you said that you approach topics, there are questions that you have, and you hold those questions, and some you go after, and some you let them lie for a while, and things like that. But could you just kind of describe your process when you're thinking about a project? You know, how do you begin to put that into some kind of order that you can follow? Can you share some insight?
Sure. So I'll give you an example of the Apostle Paul, who's one of, I just wrote a second book, Apostle Paul. There's a trilogy I'm going to do that'll probably be finished the next year or two. So the question I have with Apostle Paul is, love the Apostle. I mean, like, totally inspired, studied Greek. I even went to seminary for a while to understand the New Testament, a Reformed seminary, by the way. So so with Paul, the question was, I would read his letters intimately, original language, and I realized Paul's in a lot of fights with people, at least arguments, all the time. Read the book of Acts, or you read the Gospels are a different story, but the book of Acts, and then you read, there is a lot of conflict in the book of Acts, but not necessarily amongst the apostles about how to do this thing called mission, right? So I'd read his letters over and over, and I'm like, he seems to be opposed by just about everyone that steps inside of his church when he's not there, or writes about him, or talks about him. He winds up parting with Barnabas. He confronts James, Peter, and then meet in Galatians. And like, there's all this conflict going on. And I'm like, I just being devotional about Paul was not getting to what was going on the ground. By digging and digging and digging, I realized, oh yeah, there's a whole bunch of ethnic conflict going on about this new gospel. And there's all this thing called the honor code in Rome about giving a gift and taking a gift and owing people things, and you belong the group to the groups you gave to. And so I started unpacking and saying, this is now making more sense, because as Paul goes to the Gentiles, he's threatening ethnic unity in the original church, and they're not as comfortable as he is because the rituals change. And over time, if you want to say, as the coming of Christ tarries, then the populations of the churches grow and they overwhelmingly become Gentile, and Jews feel like they'll lose the vote. And so this is what will make sense to me, because the humanity to me is never separate from the spirituality. We don't have to be so high-minded. We're not earthly good. But in that case, I got to the point of saying, like, this is worth unpacking. And I remember when I originally did this, again, I was between a rock and a hard place, because critical scholars just want to tear everything down. And most of the more conservative scholars just want to be spiritual all the time, like almost pie in the sky, but no one was getting into, like, how do you really, they're not real to me unless they're human beings while they're struggling to figure out their callings and their destiny. So that was Paul. So then I said, okay, how do I make this case? I set up a chronology that most scholars would back, and I came up with 7 or 10 key questions I'd have to answer and have enough backing research-wise to make a case for, and then I shape it into a narrative. Then I go out and test it against real scholars to hear their feedback, almost in a Socratic way. So, like, what do you think about this? And tell me what you would say about this. And I test it all. And then if whatever falls and sticks, I put it in a narrative, try and keep 2 or 3 testimonies on every fact. Something like that, roughly like that. But it's different in each case, because I think the way you approach something stylistically could be part of your inspiration. Sometimes I feel more, and I want to do it in an isolated way. Sometimes I want to do it through conversations. So it differs, but ultimately, I think it goes from some level of inspiration and searching to some research to then expressing some stylistic way of, and wanting to give the truth to people is really a motivator, big time. Yeah.
I got a follow up question for you. Okay.
Go.
When you're considering a project, how much of the audience or the type of audience do you target an audience, and how much influence does that have, you know, when you approach, you know, filmmaking or a project?
How much time do you have? I'm gonna really try and sound profound here. So for me, I studied Paul. I'll use Paul as one example, but I think it would make sense for all the examples. So for Paul, I've studied him maybe 30 years. I probably met all the key New Testament scholars, and I've written and read articles and pretty involved. I would say it's close to what a scholar would be, an independent scholar would be. And I didn't know what Paul's real struggle was until I went out in the real world and tried to talk about the message of Paul to different audiences.
Bingo.
So this is the craziness. If you said to me, brother, what's on your heart tonight? It would be this division, this binary thinking.
Yes.
I don't think that's a Christian thing. I really don't believe that's a Christian thing. As a matter of fact, I'm suspicious that that's actually coming from somewhere else, dividing us. Because you're not of Peter, you're not of Paul, you're not, don't say you're of one, don't say you're of Silas. Like, it's not about the labels of this world, what we fit. I'm not saying you can't have a case, and believe me, I can make my case, but it's not about that. And so I think this whole binary thing we're going into, and I know we'll get to Marx, but brother, he's involved. But if you start getting into the idea of dividing the mind up, and everything is this Manichaean world, it's something I've been contending with. So to answer your question, it's almost an impossible thing to know in advance. And you're torn, because if you don't start with any audience, or people like, good luck, come show us the film when you're done. If you go too much, you don't want to slave, for me, I won't slave to an audience in advance, because I feel like it won't come out authentically, and I don't really want to do that. So what I will do is try and align to the best of my interest and inspiration with audiences. So in the case of Patton, I was like, I love Patton. I'm going to do this. This is World War II. I'm a patriot. So let's do it. Let's see where the chips fall. I didn't in advance go like, make sure Patton, but I'll give you an example where that became an issue. So there's a block of conspiratorial crowds. They're really hard. And we'll talk about it, if you guys, because I can't, I'll give you what my best take is on this. But they were like hardcore, 10%, like hardcore. But if I did something purely conspiratorial, not one college professor would have taken me serious and interviewed him myself. True. So just put yourself in that spot. I want to do something. I want to get to an audience, but 10% is going to block me from being taken serious by anyone else. Now, we could argue about the conspiracy, because it's not beyond me to believe there are reasons to do this. But that's a perfect example. So I don't think, in the end, I think it is faith. I think it is. It's not an easy road, but you just go for it, and you hope you have friends along the way, and you best align with the soldiers you have. But it's not. But the ones where I tried to be the most nuanced were the most difficult. Mm-hmm. Are the most difficult. Yep.
Okay, Robert, tell us about all your books and your documentaries that you've done. You know, recently there's one about Ronald Reagan, I believe. Yeah. And a patent, of course, and then the Pope or whatever. So tell our audience your books that you have.
Hey, wait, when you go through that list, I have a follow-up question. Which one is your favorite and why?
There you go.
Good job, Steph.
That's like,
way to go, ladies.
Like, who's your favorite kid?
That's right.
You can't answer.
No, I love them all. I love them all.
Just put them in order. Just put them in order, and then you know.
So I did. I would say let me start from Patton, which was it started about 2015 as a project, but was released 2018 with Sony Pictures in April. But I would say that what I was trying to do was I think this was somewhat intentional. So I had Patton, I had Reagan, and now I'm doing Karl Marx. But all of them, chronologically, if you watch the film, Patton goes from World War II, so he's like 39 to 45, maybe, you know, then he dies at 45, and that picks up there. And then whatever's unresolved with the communists there gets picked up in the divine plan, because it's Reagan and John Paul II have to go back and clean up the mess of what they never did during the Nixon administration, where they were doing detente and thinking they could make nice with the Soviets. And then they wind up releasing after the 89, the Berlin Wall falls. You know, we have this olive branch capitalist policy with China, like, just we'll have all this money and they'll want sneakers like us, and they'll throw off the communist regime, and we're all going to be buddies for life. And it's a complete disaster. Cut to 2020 and 500 riots in the street, all inspired by neo-Marxist movements. And I'm like, I mean, this is not going away. When we showed the divine plan quickly in 2019 and 2020, was still showing it. But when we rolled that out, we thought it was done. We thought it was like, no one's going to be that stupid. I mean, even Putin is more of a nationalist. Like, he's not going to go back to wanting this, but he is too. I mean, so this idea of Marxism, to hell with Karl Marx, is coming up next. But it's a play on words, because you could look at it as like, to hell with Karl Marx. Or you could look at it like, to hell with Karl Marx. You know, I'm raising the question of, is this someone she should pay attention to? Or like, do we have to go to hell again with this Marxist thing?
Right.
And in the film itself, I actually go to hell to meet him in the film.
That's great. That's something, man. That's great.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun.
Yeah. We have a clip. Why don't we show that clip right now? Would that interrupt your question, Steph? I don't want to be rude. If you got a favor, Steph's waiting for that. And then we'll run the clip if you would like. That'd be great. What do you say, Steph?
I don't think I have a favorite. I don't think I could say. I would have to say overall as a subject matter, probably the Apostle Paul would be my number one.
Amen. Hey, TJ, can you run the clip on that? We're just going to show that briefly. This is awesome, too. Thank you.
Part story, part dream. As old as time, boy meets girl, filled with the promise of a new family. Then the nightmare began. Were all these events just an accident, or was he behind them? The Nexus Project presents a story of spiritual destiny, a film by Robert Orlando. To Hell with Karl Marx. His writings have created never-ending revolution, created a hell on earth, but could he be stopped? To Hell with Karl Marx, The American Exorcism.
I love that.
I do too.
Exactly. I mean, I just really that. Believe I really believe it came to me because of I was just stunned because I knew Marx from college, like reading. I went through the phase where I read all like the deconstructionists and the critics of like Western civilization, because I wanted to know everything before I landed on. So you kind of throw everything up in the air in college, and so I read Marx and I knew like what the threats were, but I understood like, you know, blaming Marx for everything that goes wrong is like blaming Nietzsche for the Nazis, and it's not that simple. It's not that. So yeah. But I thought again, like, you know, Marx just keeps catching fire in so many different guises over time that I started saying to myself, this is not about economics. This is not about. And what I came to is part. I had a dream one night, which actually was this vision of going to meet Karl Marx. But the idea is that something catching fire like that has to be spiritual in nature for it to have a longer lasting potency, you know, because things die if they're limited just to their time. So I came to the conclusion that what Marx in a lot of ways is the inverse of Paul. He's promising a godless eschaton. He's promising an end of the world, but it's a godless end purely through politics and revolution. But it's an alternative to the gospel and the promise of Christ, which Paul expresses, which the end times will come. But that's more spiritual revolution of like a transformation that we're imperfect, becoming one, where Marx is cutting that all off and promising a way to do it. It's almost like the cynical, envy-based, revengeful way of correcting the world as imperfect as it is, rather than the faith journey.
Wow.
So that's what you just sensed, yeah.
I love your final quote there on the ad. Folks, this is really something. It says, he goes on to say there, the mistake of dismantling Marx as some demonized figure, but rather to confront his utopian philosophy based on blame, which has deceived and murdered millions. And here was a kicker. I like what you said. It is Orlando's last stand against Marx's wicked and beguiling death of the West fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And I think the bravery... I really am blessed and impressed by you, my friend, and the things that I think God's using you in all kinds of ways. But when I think of the Apostle Paul, what he stood up to, and I'm impressed that's your favorite. Wow, I mean, you're standing up to things and you're saying them in such a way that people are stepping back and saying, wait a minute, that's a little bit of awesome. I think that's it. Anybody else? That just gets me that way.
Tell the networks that.
You got it, bro.
No, I mean, because I'm kicking it. I'm not going to stop. But you're doing it, kicking and screaming the whole time. But I've always said you're not going to defeat a tank with a rock. You know, one documentarian is not going to take on five networks and all the high tech and all the. They'll censor me. They have already, but they'll censor me completely. Mm-hmm. And you won't know why. But it has to be confronted directly. And I'm not the only one doing it. I mean, I know Paul Kenger well, and I don't know if you read his book on the devil and Karl Marx, but also Mark Levin's book on American Marxism. So people are getting this, but they're doing it more politically, and one was doing it purely from a spirit, like a religious perspective. And I was trying to catch it more from what's so attractive, especially to young people, to want to change the whole world through violence and revolution. And it's like a promised utopia. Like, who doesn't want to grow up and suffer? Like, who wants to just blame everyone your whole life? And so it's almost like he's this perpetual adolescent trapped in this devilish character. So that's who I go to confront in the film.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful point, because I was on the Navy staff in London, and I had two small daughters at the time. And we went to Highgate Cemetery one day, and I took him to Karl Marx's grave. And, you know, he's got the copper head himself. And I wanted them to understand. We also went to Germany. And we went to his birthplace, too. And I'm not a communist, believe me. But I wanted them to understand the context.
We believe you. We believe you.
Okay, good. It's like Ghostbusters. We're ready to believe you, right?
We got it.
Anyway, what I wanted them to understand was, you know, well, several things. One was the context was Karl Marx was actually writing Das Kapital in London. And this was during the Industrial Revolution, where he saw people just being used and abused, you know, working for nothing almost in the factories. And I think deep down inside, part of him thought there's got to be a better way. And that's sort of the economic part of it. But there's also much more to it than that. And I think that's where the whole, you know, denial of God and utopia. And this has to do with human nature and an understanding that most of the young kids these days don't realize. We cannot create utopia on Earth. It's not possible because of human nature. And this is something I think the young kids today just don't understand, because they've been sort of brought up to believe in, for whatever reasons, parental inputs or educational inputs, that you can create utopia, heaven on earth, but you can't. And it's been proven you can't through people like Karl Marx, who in the 20th century was responsible for the deaths of over 100 million people. And that's what happens because of human nature. And that should make people conclude that you really can't do utopia on earth. And really, the U.S. is about as good as it can get in the imperfect human beings we all are.
Yeah,
that lines up with our faith also, what you've been saying. Right along with what he said right there, I got to watch the time. But I like what you said about your binary thoughts on conservative versus liberal, rather than camping out on each side of those lines to try to see what it's been. And I thought your definition of that was great. And it lines up with what you were just saying, Rob. And now knowing what you told Paul and Steph and everybody about your favorite being the Apostle Paul, I'm blessed, impressed, and really encouraged. We need to have you back on our program, if you'd be so kind and gracious to check and you guys look at the date, because I'd like you to address some of those things with us on how you would go about getting that message out in light of what we're seeing happening right now. I've only got 3 minutes left, and
I just want to go back. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to go back because I think it. I don't want to dismiss what was just said about Marx being real pain.
Right.
It's not. So the danger is not that the empathy can't be based on real things that people suffer. It's how you go about fixing it. And what winds up happening, the danger is when good people go to fix something in the name of being empathetic, it becomes the cover story for powerful people to get a grab of power. So it's the danger, it's the devil in the details. It's like, yeah, and brother Marx also was studied Adam Smith. He wasn't stupid. He studied the French Revolution. He studied it all. But mostly he studied on the Feuerbach and was part of the atheist movement within the Bible. So but that was his main conversion, was not, he was kind of copying Hegel in philosophy and copying Adam Smith and copying Rousseau and others in his philosophy. It wasn't original, it was derivative. But he was actually saying, I'm going to put it all of this into some spiritual framework like Hegel did, but just take God out of it. Mm-hmm. So it was the move to make it atheistic, which shut down all of this and then made it necessary for progress to only come through political revolution. That was the key moment, the closed system, like I said. So I just wanted to add that and also go back to war. I think one of my pet theories is that I have a child too, and I've gone through a lot of the things I think modern parents go through. But I just think that when you get far away from war, then the things that cause these distinctions, like we're talking about, like men and women, order, morality, all these, how to fire a gun, how to get your act together, like the timeline gets crunched down so tight that cultures have to form more solid ideas of self-identity. But as you get to third generation, it becomes a leisure class. It's all feelings-based. Any moment you could just hold up your iPhone and figure out the whole world and you're well, the whole world's around you. So I think all of this, what I'm getting at is that these are like things that we always know are there, but are now gone under the surface. And they're just not being addressed. And they're not being addressed in a lot of the traditional media sources because they're too busy being in the binary to make money. This is the problem. Mm-hmm. This is the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Excellent. Boy, friends, listen, where'd our time go? This has been so great. I got to put one spot in here really quick, Robert. Ladies and gentlemen, listen, you know our program is faith-based. It's also based by all of you who tune in. You're a wonderful, wonderful audience. Go to our website. We need your donations. We need your support. That's bbsradio.com/raising expectations. There's a tab there for PayPal. Thanks for all of you that do donate, because we want to bring men and women like Robert here to give you insight, wisdom, and to raise your expectations because you got a better view. That was a great definition that you just gave. It just takes the evening news and gives it a whole new slant when you try to look at it that way. Robbie, you don't want to put you on the spot, but we'd sure like to have you back on our program if at all possible. We've run out of time. And if your permission, we'll check back with you. And with that work out, we'll try to get back to you.
That sounds great. Let me just say www.silencepatton.com. Please go get the film and the book. And if you want to do an online event, we could also do an online event where we can get a crowd together and you guys could be the panel for a big event.
We're going to work on that.
Try it.
We're going to work on that.
Say it again, Robert.
We have an online platform where we could set up an online event for a big audience. So we could,
the website.
Let me give you this, because I've absolutely run out of time. I've got to give this. Robomantics, RobomanTix.com. Find out everything about Robert right there, Robomantics.com. It's all right there. Folks, we just ran out of time. We need a four-hour program for something this good. Robert, God bless you and Margo and your family and your mom in New York.
Thanks so much, Robert. Appreciate it. Great to meet you.
All right,
we'll be talking
Thank you, guys.
To you.
Sure, we'll talk soon. Take care.
Bye-bye for now.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. See y'all next week.
Let's do this again.
Friends, thanks for joining us on this week's program of Raising Expectations. We profoundly hope you found it engaging and at times humorous, but most of all, uplifting, so that we may, with you, one topic at a time each week, become more encouraged to move forward to an exciting future in, as we always say, this thing called life in America today. So let not your hearts be troubled, your family, finances, faith, freedom. It can be a great future as we talk, listen, respect, and pull together. Please let me hear from you. You can reach me at 972-922-8556. That's 972-922-8556, or Joe Schofield on Facebook or LinkedIn. It'd be a pleasure to know you, and we hope you'll listen in again next week on the BBS Radio Network.